Well, welcome, everybody. Good morning and good afternoon. This is Mark Reynolds from Citizens Climate Lobby. You are on the May Citizens Climate Lobby International Call. What's going to be happening is in just a moment, I'm going to introduce our guest speaker. And after his comments, we'll get reports of what's happened since last month's call. We'll go over the actions for this month, and we will practice a laser talk. And as usual, there was a lot of activity generated, which is great. You know, there's at least two reasons that it's important people are in action every month. One is, even the laws of physics tell us if we want to move something, the only way to do it is to take action upon it, and certainly the condition of climate policy in the U.S. and Canada is in an unacceptable place at this point, and so we need to take action every single month. But also, I loved what Peter Joseph, our group leader in Marin, said. He said, action is the antidote for despair. Action is the antidote for despair. And I think if you take it from his world, Peter is a retired MD. You know, in the medical world, they have a diagnostic code, an ICD-9 code, and so Peter might say, big problem. Then they have what's called a procedural code, a CPT code, which is, what are you going to do about it? And Peter says, take action. So I like that. Action is the antidote for despair. It's very easy to worry about the size of the problem we have. And to keep our spirits up, not only to solve the problem, but to keep our spirits up, it's important that we're in action every single month. Now, before I introduce our speaker, I want to welcome our two newest groups. So last week, we started groups in Portland and Eugene. Last Sunday afternoon, we arrived at what we thought was a restaurant with a private room, and what we walked into was a bar. So I don't know how many of you saw the movie Crazy Horse, but in the opening scene, you have Jeff Bridges, a washed-up country singer, who looks out of the place where he's going to be performing, and he goes, it's a bowling alley. So Tamara, the organizer who drove me there, we walked around a little bit, we looked around, we go, we're going to be doing a group start in a bar. And she looks me in the eye, and she said, we're going to make this work. So we slid 14 chairs off into a corner, and I really do not think it would have been possible to make that work without the, it's just how intentional the people in that group were and having it be successful. We had 14 people there the very next morning. They met with the editorial board of the Portland Oregonian. They've already submitted their first op-ed. And, you know, it's the only group start we've had where part of the discussion you would hear were things like, and we need to get to 350 parts per million, followed by, does anybody want a beer or a hamburger? So Portland, welcome. That was great. Loved being there. The next day we were down in Eugene. Milton and his team put 35 people in the room, which was a spectacular piece of organizing, including he had someone who was recording, making an audio recording that he said would go to 180 NPR stations. So it's possible a lot of what we covered in the Group Start workshop will actually get a very wide distribution. So Milton and your team, that's just a really, really great job of filling a room. And also, I just want you to know that having you and all eight people of your organizing group be there to greet me when I got off the train just made the whole thing even more special, and I felt really, really welcomed by that. Okay, so our guest speaker, Major General Jackson, recently retired from the United States Marine Corps after 36 years of service. Prior to his retirement, Major General Jackson served as the Commanding General, Marine Corps Installations West. Mindful of the strategic risks inherent in petroleum-based fuels, Jackson has been a strong advocate of Defense Department initiatives to use more money from clean, renewable sources and less from fossil fuels. His personal decorations include the Navy Distinguished Service Medal, the Defense Superior Service Medal, the Legion of Merit Medal with two gold stars for second and third award, the Bronze Star Medal, the Defense Meritorious Service Medal, the Meritorious Service Award with two gold stars, and the Navy Commendation Medal with one gold star. Wow. Major General Jackson, good morning and welcome, and thank you so much for being on our call today.
Good morning, and thank you for that warm introduction. I only came in the Marine Corps for 3 years, but I was captivated by many of the good things that it was trying to do for this nation and to serve the nation and to serve people like people on this conference was a real pleasure. So I would ask that you, if you want, I can go through a whole kind of a speech, and then if you want to do address any questions, I'll be glad to do that after.
Yeah, good. That would be great. And I do have some questions that I'd love to get to, and I'm hoping we'll have time to get questions from the group, which if there is time, we'll start in Leucadia and then Tucson and Atlanta. It'll just depend on time. But I would hope that in your comments, you know, I live 2 miles from the Marine Corps Recruiting Depot here in San Diego, and I hope in your comments you can include some of the things that are happening with bases around the world.
Oh, absolutely. I'll be more than glad to tell you some of the things that are happening right in your own backyard there.
Great.
Well, let me start out by saying that I dedicated myself for over 36 and a half years to serving this nation in any time and place, as is the desire of anybody who wears a uniform of the United States Marine. The idea of going overseas and serving, you try to do with a great deal of honor. But I've been able to reflect on my career, and I'm very proud of that. But this idea of renewable energy, if you all sit back and think for a lot of people come from different angles, climate change, getting more, cleaning the air, cleaning the water, all the things. Vital for the next generations of Americans. And we owe them something. And one of the reasons I serve is not just for our generation, but for future generations, those who may be my grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, etc. We have, if you think about it, we have been in constant war for an entire generation that was born in 1990. They have known the U.S. to be engaged in war ever since the August 2nd of that day, of that year, when Saddam invaded the oil fields of Kuwait. At that time that he did that, I was a young major sitting at a desk, the Europe, Middle East, Africa desk in the Pentagon, and my phone rang just within seconds of my assuming my nighttime duties on August the 2nd, and there was a hysteric voice on the phone. And I couldn't understand it, and I couldn't make out the accent. So I asked the gentleman on the other end of the line to please calm down and say very slowly what the intent of his call was. I was in the National Military Command Center, the first point of contact when any military action is about to take place in the United States, especially a surprise action. And he calmly told me in a heavy Middle Eastern accent that the U.S. Embassy has been overrun by the Iraqis. Being only a major at the time, I said, just a minute, you want to speak to a general. So I went over to my general and I told him that the Iraqis were at the U.S. Embassy and they had captured Kuwait. That was nearly 22 years ago. So you could have been born that year and have graduated from college, and all you've ever known is your nation. And what was the primary purpose of that war? Well, we are overly dependent on fossil fuels generated from the Middle East and elsewhere when you get right down to it. It has cost the generation only war, but it has cost the United States nearly 5,000 lives and tens of thousands of damaged bodies in just Iraq, and over 1,900 lives, and again, thousands of wrecked bodies and mines. The price of fossil fuel is measured more than just the environment. It's measured in our absolute willingness to pay the lives of generations, and as we continue today, pay lives in generations. We have decided it is worth the blood of the nation. We've decided it is worth the treasure of the nation, each of those wars. Now, each, not all together, has cost the United States over $100 billion in at a time when our economy itself suffers. Today, we have sailors, Marines, airmen, Coast Guardmen deployed around the world to protect our strategic petroleum supply. We could do a lot better. And in 2009, right before I assumed my last duties as the commanding general for the Marine Corps installations west of the Mississippi, the president had already laid out some very ambitious goals to break our dependence on oil by promoting a next generation of cars and trucks, and produce more energy at home by enhancing U.S. energy supplies through responsible development of domestic renewable energy, included fossil fuels, advanced biofuels, and nuclear energy. So the Secretary of the Navy in August of 2009 convened all of the most senior generals and admirals. And he said that we are, in fact, going to launch a fleet which can basically sail around the world not using fossil fuels. He wanted to use biofuels and still a dependence on nuclear vessels. He wanted to reduce, he announced that the Navy and the Marine Corps would reduce their dependence on petroleum use for all of our non-tactical vehicles that we use to run and maintain our bases and installations. Said that we would, in fact, increase our own alternative energy production ashore by 50% by 2020. And finally, he would increase our total energy use in the Department of the Navy by 40% by 2020. The Commandant of the Marine Corps, taking his cues from the Secretary of the Navy, his boss, says we're going to reduce our energy intensity on our bases and our installations by 30% by 2015, and he included that we were going to reduce our consumption of water and at the same time increase the percentage of renewable electrical energy consumed by 25% by FY 2025. So they laid out some very ambitious goals for us. And I can tell you that we have the Department of the Navy, led perhaps by the Marine Corps and supported immensely by our Navy brothers, who are responsible for construction on military bases that belong to the Navy or the Marine Corps. Absolutely been knocking the ball out of the park on accomplishing these goals. Mark, I'm pleased to tell you that by June of this year, MCRD San Diego, the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego, through the use of solar, will be 100% using renewable energy to supply its electrical needs on base. They just, if you go to that base, and you can go in there, Mark, all you have to do is pull out your driver's license, tell them you just want to view the base or see the museum or something, you'll see the tremendous amount of solar panels that they have put. And of all places, they put it on top of the roof of all of their new construction, but on the parade deck where the recruits graduate every year, you'll notice that the bleachers, just about a quarter mile of bleachers, all of the shade over the bleachers are, in fact, solar panels.
Right. Yeah. Hey, General Jackson, can I just interrupt you for 1 second? Can you just get a little bit closer to your phone and speak up a little bit? I just got a text from one of the groups saying they couldn't quite hear you.
Okay. I'll try. I'll give it. Hopefully, this is better for them.
Okay.
In addition, right down the road from you, at Marine Corps Air Station in Coronado, You can probably see one of our best examples of multiple use of renewable energy. The base had a landfill that it had leased to the city of San Diego for over 30 years. Well, we discovered that not only was that thing polluting the air with release of methane gases, but that we could capture that methane gas and turn it into electrical fuel by just building a 2-mile connector between the garbage dump and the base, and putting putting the right equipment on it. And now, as of June, at Marine Corps Air Station in Miramar, find that they receive 100% federal energy credits for their use of renewables from that land. Methane capture plant that they put on their landfill. The Marine Corps has also put up a wind turbine. We're doing geothermal research. Our base in Barstow, California, uses a wind turbine, a single thing, to provide 20% of its energy and they're about ready to build a second, more efficient one. The real key to all of this is that we have been driven. We've been driven by the true cost of fuel to the U.S. military. For us to get a gallon of fuel to our troops in Afghanistan, it's about $100 per gallon. But even more critically, for every 50 trucks that we put on the road, we're going to receive, we know it mathematically, assuredly, we're going to receive at least one casualty. And 70% of all the vehicles that move on the roads for our troops in Afghanistan, and as in just about any war, is either fuel or water. So those are necessities. But at the same time that we're updating our bases and we're meeting and exceeding the goals for using renewables, it's strategically imperative that we continue to set example for the rest of the nation. We have been, you know, the curse of war is that yes, it costs, but part of this cost has allowed us to grab hold of renewable energies as an imperative that we grab it on our bases, on our ships, in our airplanes. If any of you have ever seen the Blue Angels flying demonstration team of the Navy Marine Corps, last year they were flying their jets using biofuel at the public demonstrations that they give around the country. That's part of the proof of part of our effort to say, hey, this can be done, and we can break the chokehold that Middle Eastern oil has on both the U.S. economy and our, over-reliance on fossil fuels. So as we march forward, and as the Navy, Marine Corps, but this is all of the Department of Defense, if we could make this happen, then surely the American public can make it happen. I was struck by a Secretary of Defense's comment at a speech I heard when he said, you know, the improvised explosive device, the infamous IED, that causes life and limb than any other weapon to our soldiers, Marines, sailors, is that we should turn countering the IED into the Manhattan Project of our time. And the Manhattan Project, for those of you who didn't do well in history, it was the project where we developed the atomic bomb. Well, I thought that statement was not quite right. The Manhattan Project of our time should be the development of renewable energy, not only for the protection of our air, our water, our climate, but for the saving of us in cost to our economy, the saving of us of the next generations. Sometimes we look at things like 9/11 and we say the dirty son of a gun that killed 3,000 Americans and people from around the world, internationally, 3,000 people. Sometimes you have to look at the root causes of those things. The root cause was on August 2nd, 1990, we started deploying troops to the Middle East to protect our petroleum pipelines in the Middle East. We stayed. In our staying, we gave people like Osama bin Laden a theme. We gave them a reason for being, or a reason for attacking our own sovereign territory. We can't dismiss that. Did we do it intentionally? No. But in fact, it was one of the main reasons for the growth of groups like Al-Qaeda. So the Department of Defense is on board in this struggle to break the chokehold that we have limiting placed on ourselves. And so if you're out there, if you're developing electrical vehicles or more efficient solar panels or exploring for geothermal or fighting for the climate change, clean air, clean water, believe it or not, one of your greatest partners can be the Department of Defense. So with that kind of as my concluding remarks, I'll be glad to entertain any questions.
Okay, great. So what we're going to do is we'll start in Leucadia, California, then Tucson, Arizona, and Atlanta, depending upon how long the answers are to the questions. So, Leucadia, you would need to *6 your phone to unmute it. Judy, does someone have a question up there?
Yes, this is Davia. Thank you very much. Really inspired by what you said. And my question is, if you've testified before Congress before, can you give us some advice on discussing climate and or energy issues with Congress?
Oh, man, Congress. You know, as a general, I used to never comment about Congress. But what I haven't testified before Congress. Now, I've talked to the state legislature here in California. I've talked to their people, and I talked to legislatures individually in Maryland not long ago. But my advice, I mean, this is certainly when we address it as a climate change issue, it is extremely, only a climate change issue. It is extremely volatile from a political standpoint. One says yes, one says no. And what I would say is to wrap this up. When I had my most success in Maryland in my discussions with legislators, it was really talking about it from a national security and what would you do if the $100 billion we put in Afghanistan and the $100 billion that we put in Iraq each year, how would it benefit your economy? I mean, people, national security and economy, if you can always include that in your scientific arguments, you know, it's like trying to convince certain groups in certain areas of the country about the theories of evolution. You know, you're going to, and climate change. So I would tie it in a broad to national security and economic issues. People hear that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that answer. All right, let's check with Tucson. Vince, does anybody in Tucson have a question this morning?
Actually, we have three questions. Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay. You get to start with one, and then we'll decide if we like your second and third.
Right. Which one do we like the best? We like... Okay. We like a question about biofuels.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read this? I'm going to let Barbara Warren read it. Dr. Barbara Warren of Physicians for Social Responsibility is going to read it because she wrote it.
Okay. Great.
And PDA. Could you comment on the advisability of the use of biofuels, which can be potential threats to international food security, particularly when we're using food crops like corn?
Yes. I mean, we're right next to Scripps Laboratory, it's kind of interesting. The Department of Defense, the Department of Navy is working hand in hand. Last year I visited the lab at Scripps and had the people come visit our base, and they're developing, they're working on biofuels. But like I mentioned, we're already, you know, we have the F-18 Hornet, which is the principal fighter jet for the Navy and the Marine Corps. And during the course of the last 2 years, we've been flying demonstration aircraft using biofuels. And therefore, the F-18 Hornet is now known as the Green Hornet to some. Also, recently, USS Macon-Kentley, a new ship that was just launched last year, deployed using biofuels and what we call hybrid. So we don't use a lot of biofuels, although if you go on the bases and installations, which I commanded, you'll see vehicles run by both electricity, hydrogen, et cetera. Matter of fact, in a 2.5-year period, we reduced our a consumption of carbon fuels by over 30% by going to electrical and electrical powered by solar, by the way, rechargers. And so we're heading in that direction. Right now it's a matter of volume. The billion, you know, the Department of Defense is the largest user of energy of any government and probably most industries. And so we're looking and we're working with universities to come up with a solution that can produce it in the kind of volume that's required. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, I think that the separate issue is particularly, you know, energy that comes from corn drives up food prices internationally. So, you know, certainly others than something, corn ethanol or something that we would be really interested in encouraging also, because we don't want it to, particularly ethanol, impact poor people who depend so much on corn, I think is the second part of that. Tucson, we may have time to come back for second questions, but first of all, let me give Atlanta a chance to ask the question they had.
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, General Jackson, thanks so much for joining us today. Earlier this week, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta raised concerns about the national security implications of climate change. And he told an audience, quote, "The area of climate change has a dramatic impact on national security, rising sea levels, severe droughts, the melting of the polar caps, the more frequent and devastating natural disasters all raise demand for humanitarian assistance and disaster relief," end quote. So have you been looking at the security risks we may face from climate change in the future, and what are your concerns in this regard?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, certainly Department of Defense has been looking at this actually for decades. And, you know, despite the fact that we have been engaged in the Middle East in conflict for these 20 years, one of the identifiers that in terms of climate change overall is, you know, water resources, water wars, which may be a bigger deal on the international scene. And if you live in the southwestern United States, you know, it's a big deal here too. There are great strategic implications in terms of the United States having to respond more and more to disasters brought about by climate change, shortages of water. It's kind of unpredictable in a way. And because it's unpredictable, it means that you have to make your best guess. And then you have to, from a Department of Defense standpoint, you try to spend dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars each year, which puts you in the best position to be able to respond to those things. It would be nice if those things which we have an impact on, if we could all chip in and reduce the probability. Now, it is, in fact, you know, how much does man and his animals contribute to climate change? And then for every scientific calculation that says, hey, we contributed a lot, then we need the scientific effort to reduce that and the personal efforts to reduce that impact. So you don't have to, all of these things result in hundreds of billions of dollars in defense expenditures, and some of them, quite frankly, are things that that we self-generate. So the secretary has it right. You can look at the national intelligence estimates, and you will see that climate change is of great concern. So,
great. Okay, last question we'll have time for. We know that active military are apolitical as part of their commitment. We have enormous amount of respect for that. Nevertheless, more visibility from active and retired military on this issue will certainly help us create room for people to vote the right way who've backed themselves into the corner on the science. What kind of guidance would you give us to get more, military presence on this issue? Because, it creates political cover for people who need it right now.
Yeah. There are, in each of the departments of the Army, Navy, Air Force, there is an assistant secretary, and in the Department of Defense, it's the Honorable Mr. Conger, C-O-N-G-E-R. And in the Department of Navy, it's the Honorable Miss Fannin-Steele, and she is a Californian too, by the way. And those people go right to the uniform guys like myself. And they're very, and they're the resource fighters, and they bring the generals, industry, academia, all together to wrestle with this problem. So in the two, the upper echelon, Mr. Conger, C-O-N-G-E-R, in the Department of Defense, and then Ms. Fannin-Steele in the Department of the Navy, because that's kind of my chain that I've worked with for the years. But there are counterparts in each of the other departments, too. So I would say that, and I think the admirals and the generals are energized to this issue. And so I would say, though, but I would start at the secretarial level and make contact with those two people I just gave you, especially number one would be Mr. Conger, who has oversight for all the services. And they will help you carry your message. When I was on active duty, we would meet once a year. That is the uniforms from all of the services in the southwestern United States, where the majority, where all of my bases were. But all of the uniform services, along with industry, academic, Native American peoples, and Mr. Conger would be the chairman of the meeting. This year it's being held in September, I believe, in Sacramento. Last year it was in Salt Lake City. The previous year it was in Albuquerque. So, but this year, Mr. Conger will chair that meeting with the uniformed services and interested people in Sacramento in September. It is a great forum to discuss and keep energized this. Not only that, he has a little bit of a finger on DOD budgeting for projects. So that's kind of where I would direct you to try to get involved with that. And if you need more information offline, I can research. Of course, I've been on the retired list since January 1st, so I'll have to make sure the right contacts are still in place. But I could probably assist you if you wanted to participate in that conference.
We would. We'll definitely take you up on that. We appreciate that very much.
Yeah. But it's a real pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate what you all are doing, and I think that, maybe you don't want to call it the Manhattan Project of your time, but come up with a good name that we because that would catch the American public's ear, and I think scientifically there are answers out there, and we're getting better at it, but we're not there yet.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. You know, there's a lot of things once people give up, they can get back. You know, if people's investments go sideways, they can fix them. If the people's relationships get funky, they can go to work on that. But one thing you can never get back is your time, and I appreciate that you would make yourself available on a Saturday. You're certainly welcome if you want to stick around for a little bit and hear the kinds of things people accomplished since last month's call. But I know you're busy, so if you have to drop off, I'll understand that. But thank you so much for your service to our country, and thank you for being on our call today.
I appreciate the opportunity to engage with you. Thank you.
Great. Fabulous. Okay, great. All right. Well, in just a moment, I'm going to ask Amy Bennett to give us a summary of the results that you all produced in Canada and the U.S. this month. Before that, I do want to say thank you to everybody who contributed during our spring fundraiser, everybody who's contributed so far. Obviously, an organization that doubles in size every year, there are costs that go up. So the cost of this call, because there's more people on it every month, goes up. The cost of getting around to all the group start goes up because the volume of them is increasing, and certainly the cost for the national conference increase because that conference is doubling in size every year also. So for everybody who has had a chance or will still, it works for you to contribute in the spring fundraiser, thank you so much, and I want you to know that your money is being well spent. So, Amy Bennett, are you there?
Yes, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you tell us if we got anything done this month?
I sure can. It was another just great, great month. Starting off with meetings with members of Congress and Parliament, we had 26 editorial board meetings, one letter to the editors, 29, two editorials, 11 op-eds, and I'm going to just take a moment to go through that list because that is just incredible. We had one in the San Diego Tribune, one in the Gainesville Sun in Florida, one in the Deseret News in Salt Lake City, Utah, one in the Tallahassee Democrat, one in the Press Citizen in Iowa City, one in the Observer in Detroit, one in the Echo Press, Minnesota, Times of Trenton in New Jersey, actually two in New Jersey, one in the Star Ledger in New Jersey, and in Pennsylvania, the Center Daily Times. So that's quite a list. Also, we had 10 TV and radio interviews, 154 million letter March letters, 45 education and outreach. I think that's a lot of Earth Day events that we had going on there. And we are up to now a total of 35 SOCA support letters. And I wanted to point out also that there was one event in Washington, D.C., a conference that was started up by Tom English of the Encinitas Group. It was the National Religious Coalition for Creation Care. It was a climate conference where Bill McKibben spoke, James Hansen spoke, and Mark Reynolds of Citizens Climate Lobby spoke. That's our report. It's just really a terrific month. Thank you.
Okay, great. And just to add an emphasis to a couple of things. So Amy mentioned 35 SOCA letters. We're only counting those from organizations like the ones we've gotten from churches and also from organizations like 350 who signed it. Many of you have generated tons of individual signers, but we're only counting the organizational ones because those are the ones that we're going to show members of Congress. So we didn't miss out all the individual ones you got. We're just going to report on the ones that are from groups. Now, there's a couple of efforts we're aimed towards in Canada. There's going to be a big lobbying effort in June in Ottawa and also for our national conference in July. There were some important meetings that happened towards both those this month. So some of the members of Congress are particularly notable that we met with this month because they're people who've been heavily involved in crafting climate legislation. So we met with Senator Cantwell's office, the author of the CLEAR Act. We met with Senator Kerry's office. Certainly Senator Kerry has been in the middle of every attempt at climate policy legislation for years. We went with Representative Larson's office of Connecticut, who let us know that he will be introducing climate legislation again soon. We met with Senator McCain in his office in Tucson. And again, Senator McCain has been a big Republican lead sponsor on a lot of climate legislation. Great work on that, Tucson. We went with Senator Lindsey Graham's office of South Carolina. Again, Senator Graham has been a big crossover Republican vote on this issue, so that was important. And then lastly, we met with Representative Waxman's office of Waxman Markey. So those are all pushing towards us getting legislation put in place to get passed in the next Congress. In terms of some of the outreach events that I want to mention, there were 86 people at an event in Coronado, California, that was put on by the Coronado Group. Connie, great work, and Marshall had a lot to do with that. We had five of our scientists from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography Group who all presented, and what they talked about was their area of specialty in the ocean. So it ranged everything from a woman who was an expert on the 41 different kind of mammals that live around our area to the chemistry of the ocean. We filmed that event. We're hoping that the quality of the film is something that we can get out to everybody. Although Amy mentioned it, I do want to mention that Iowa got an op-ed because they asked their paper if they could get a monthly column. And the paper agreed, and Bill, that was a beautiful piece again. Congratulations to the Iowa group. And every time something like that happens, it gives the rest of us the opportunity to ask our paper for the same thing. In Winnipeg, Christine put on an event called Creation in Peril. 70 people attended that. Great job, Winnipeg, Christine. Fabulous work. And then the terms of the editorial board meetings, Amy mentioned the Deseret News in Salt Lake City. What's important about the Deseret News and the work that Bill and Dave and the Salt Lake City chapter have been doing is that newspaper is owned by the Mormon Church. So if you look at the Utah congressional delegation, it is made up entirely, or almost entirely, of people of the LDS faith, and for that paper to be speaking out has a huge amount of influence on them. So that is a great piece of work, everybody. Then one of the things Kathy does is she sends me a note about what happens with political visits in Canada this month. Here's her short note. She said, "We like to keep our conversations between ourselves and politicians confidential, but in general, we can say that in the last 6 weeks in Ontario, three members of provincial parliament from two different political parties have said that they like the Carbon Fee and Dividend Act. Please bear in mind that they all come from parties whose official platform is cap and trade. Thus, it appears we're starting to find converts. One in particular said that the carbon fee and dividend had all the right ingredients, and this politician would take the carbon fee and dividend act to people in her party who, quote, hate carbon taxes, and see what they say. And then another MPP stopped us about 2 minutes into our lobbying session and said, is this the bill that Jim Hansen is proposing? And we said yes, and he said something top secret that we cannot share yet, but soon, so people lobbying your MPPs, as keep lobbying your MPPs as things might get exciting. Kathy, great report. Thank you so much. Okay, Steve Balk, if you could do a couple of things for us now. If you could tell us the actions for both Canada and for the U.S., and also give us this month's laser talk, and then introduce Ellie Whitney as part of some background information on the actions this month. Are you there, Steve?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Wonderful. Great. Well, let's start with the Canadians. So the actions that the Canadians will be doing this month, one will be to use the laser talk and the Broken Earth Day editorial packet to help people write letters to the editor, following the climate impact day of action that's happening today, May 5th. And then the second action for the Canadians will be to make plans for the Federal Environment Week up in Ottawa, things like, getting meetings with members of Parliament and things like that. So that would be the second thing for the Canadians today, would be to make plans for that big week coming up in Ottawa. So here in the U.S., we are going to ask faith-based communities to sign on to the letter of support for the Save Our Climate Act, and we'll get a little bit more help here from Ellie Whitney on that action here shortly. Then the second action will be to write letters to members of Congress pointing out the connection between extreme weather events and climate change, and ask them to support legislation to price carbon. And then our third request this month would be to request meetings with members of Congress or their staff in Washington during our lobbying days at the international conference. So, Mark, you want me to go ahead with this month's laser talk?
Yeah, and as part of that, Steve, we were really hoping that you will write those letters today before you go home, so that you actually write a handwritten note to your member of Congress. Let's get that done before we leave. It just significantly increases the likelihood of it happening if we do it before we leave today. Okay, yeah, Steve, laser talk, and then introduce Ellie, please.
Great. Okay, so this month's laser talk. As the Cowardly Lion said after waking up in a snow-covered poppy field, unusual weather we're having, ain't it? All across North America and the world, we're seeing extreme weather events that are occurring with ever greater frequency. Prolonged droughts, intense rainfall that causes disastrous floods, record-breaking heat waves. Scientists are now connecting the dots between our warming climate and the increasing frequency of these extreme weather events. They tell us that our juiced climate has loaded the dice and increased the odds that such events will happen. As the weather becomes more unpredictable and dangerous, everyone will feel the impacts. Floods and droughts, storms, rising insurance premiums, rising food prices, water shortages. We need to reverse the process that is heating up our planet and increasing extreme weather events. We need to put a price on carbon that reduces our greenhouse gas emissions. Representative, will you support a tax on carbon-based fuels that returns revenue to American households? Great. So that is the laser talk for this month. And as Mark mentioned, we're really encouraging people to write those letters today. And our friends at 350.org, who are doing the Connect the Dots events around the world today, we shared this action with them, and they're very excited about it, and they've been telling their folks about it too. So this is a way that you can kind of be participating with what's going on with the 350 events today. So, Ellie Whitney, are you on the line? You might have to do the star six thing.
Oh, I'm on the line.
You are on the line. Great, great. So this month's action is to get commitments from faith-based communities on the Save Our Climate Act. And this is actually Ellie's idea, and she's done a lot of work in her community reaching out to faith groups. So we've assembled a lot of resources to help you with this action, but you still might look at this all and go, gosh, where do I start? How do I do this? And Ellie's been doing this, and so Ellie, I'd like you to share a little bit about, you know, what your approach has been to do this.
Thank you, Steve. It's just wonderful to have the chance to share this with you. I have been cowed by politicians, but I find it a much easier task to approach houses of worship because they are not political for the most part, and we can get large numbers of people at a time from houses of worship. So here's the approach I suggest. First, become friends with some key members of the congregation. You could start with your own. Then get their help to ask the whole congregation to support the legislation. Here's what I've done so far. About a half a year ago, I was invited to speak at a little Hadassah group on the climate crisis, and I made friends with one of the leaders of that group. And then it occurred to me that I could ask her to get the whole group to support the legislation, and she did, and we got 45 people at one stroke. Then I ventured to win my own church, which is the UU Congregation of Princeton. That's some 250 people. I asked my minister if he would let my daughter Lynn and myself help him with the sermon on Earth Day and then present a resolution to the congregation. He was willing. The sermon went well, and then I met with the Board of Trustees about the resolution. The board suggested some good changes, then they approved it, and I'll be presenting it to the general meeting of the congregation early next month. I believe it will pass easily. Meanwhile, I wrote a little article about a little church in Princeton that had put solar panels on its roof in 2006 for climate reasons. The op-ed was published, they loved it, and then I visited them, and I loved them, and now I'm attending that church regularly as well as my own church. I got to know the elders who had led that solar initiative. They asked me to meet with the board with a resolution for their congregation. The board approved, and I'll be presenting the resolution about 10 days from now. I think that group then wants to take the resolution to a large, I think they call it a synod, of the churches of their denomination. This coming Tuesday, I'm meeting with a clergy group at a local Lutheran church. The pastor seems very receptive. After that, I have a list of about 40 other houses of worship near here that I can visit next. Meanwhile, in Richmond, Virginia, CCL volunteer Monica Lewis has written a resolution for the Episcopal Church. Monica dreams boldly. The Episcopal Church holds its National General Convention only once every 3 years, and she is in under the wire proposing to present a resolution at their next meeting, which is very soon. Congregation members and priests are supporting her. The most wonderful thing I have discovered is that faith groups are really not very political, so when you invite them to do something important and good, they are interested and supportive. Here's my suggestion. When you visit an Episcopal church, tell them Monica's story. When you visit a Catholic church, take the Vatican statement with you. Always work in person. Don't do this by email or by phone. Take copies of all the documents that we have provided in this month's CCL action sheet. This initiative seems to have a much better chance than a snowball in hell. It seems more like a bouquet in heaven. That's my story.
Brilliant. Yeah, great. All right, and Ellie, so well done. Anything I say about it is just going to diminish it somehow, so I'm just going to leave it be. Steve, there's one big addition in terms of speakers to the conference. Could you mention who that is?
Yes, we have economist Jeffrey Sachs is going to be speaking to a joint plenary of Results and Citizens Climate Lobby. And for those of you who don't know who Jeffrey Sachs is, in the world of economists, he's kind of a rock star. And he, when the Iron Curtain fell in Eastern Europe and all of the communist countries were converting from communism to capitalism, he was the guy that a lot of those countries turned to help them with their transition to capitalism. So he kind of got a name for himself with that. And then after that, he started focusing on how to end poverty in the world, and in particular, he became a very big champion of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. He had a book out some years ago called The End of Poverty, a very, very well-read book by a lot of folks. So he's worked very closely with results over the years, but he has also drawn a lot of connections between poverty and the impact that climate change is having on the poor throughout the world. And in fact, he's also advocated for a carbon tax. So we're real excited to be a part of that that joint plenary with results, and looking forward to hearing from Dr. Sachs at the conference in July.
Thank you, Steve. Speaking of the conference, at the conclusion of last year's conference, Ellie Sparks in Richmond sent a note to us, and she asked if she could read that note to just give people a picture who've never been there on today's call. Are you there, Ellie?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Barely. Can you get closer to the phone?
I am close to the phone. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Now you're great. Now I can hear you crystal clear.
Okay, I'm going to read my letter, but I also want to say quickly that Ellie Whitney and I met at the conference last year and lobbied together, and at one point, feeling the weight of the issue we were lobbying for and thrilled by our courage, we sat down in the hallways of Congress and wept together, holding each other. And listening to her right now just brought me to tears. So anyway, here's what I wrote to you. Just a few thoughts on the conference. I have birthed two children at home, one in water. I have traveled to Denmark and lived there for a year teaching myself Danish. I have lived on small, back-to-the-land family farms in northern Maine and New Brunswick, Canada, perfecting skills in draft horse farming. I have facilitated my son's healing, managing his care through 5 years of back-to-back open heart surgeries. I have opened profound and delicious doors of healing for my family. I have done all of these things and more. The CTL conference heads straight to the top of my list of life-affirming experiences. I had tender feelings I never expected. I felt safe and supported, which allowed my courage to expand. I felt strong and feminine. I absolutely adored the partnership I experienced with my CCL colleagues, I'm sorry, in each and every meeting. Sometimes we were five in a meeting. Sometimes we were two. One time we were one. All of CCL was in every meeting. I loved how our synergy grew. We invited and encouraged each other's best and most delicious qualities. I loved the uprides after each meeting. I want to honor the trust by naming it here, too. It was profound and powerful in a centering and connecting way. We looked for the light and found it every time. A smile, a softening, eyes brightening, arms uncrossing, even tears. There were beautiful and affirming moments. The men and women of Congress have started down the path of what will become the most rewarding thing they have ever done in their professional careers, perhaps even in their lives. It will also be the most challenging. It will require courage they never knew they had. That extra courage is there for them because we planted it this week. We planted the courage and revived the will. Our breakthroughs are their breakthroughs and belong to the world. I am so grateful. Thank you. Love, Ellie.
Thank you. Love, Ellie. Oh, gosh, thank you so much for that. So beautiful, so lovely. It's as touching to me today as it was a year ago. The last thing on today's call that I wanted to do is our group leader in Washington, D.C., Niels, is moving back to Germany on Wednesday. And I had talked to Niels quite a few times, but didn't actually meet him in person until the international conference in Washington, D.C. last June. And my initial impression of him was this was the single most argumentative person I had ever met in my life, and started to spend time in the conference figuring out how not to call on him, because he has a way of raising his hand where you can't see anything in the room but Niels. But nevertheless, he somehow transformed from Mr. Argumentative to building a really remarkable piece of Citizens Climate Lobby in Washington, D.C. So he started pretty much by himself for about 6 months, and then build a core team with Siren and Yiming and Erica, where now they've built spreadsheets that track every member of Congress, take all of our debriefing reports, color code them so we know who's with us, who's against us, who's in between. They've helped to build our social media strategy, helped to build our fundraising efforts, And Nils has been constantly making us, getting us in connection with conservative think tanks so that we're dealing with this issue from the broadest possible place. So, Nils, I just want to say I'm glad that you can go back to Germany, but we are so much a better organization for you having been a part of it, and it's just it has been really, really great to have you here. Ellie, you had something else you wanted to add on that?
Yes, I wanted to add something. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Okay. Well, Nils actually reached out to me before I even had met him and came down to Richmond and met with some of our members. And then I saw him at the conference, and I just remember going into meetings with him and really appreciating his knowledge and his willingness to meet the Tea Party kinds of people where they were. He also, it was so wonderful for my birthday. He didn't know this was happening on my birthday, but the Republicans for Environmental Protection had their annual meeting, and he called me up and said, wouldn't I like to come? And so he bought tickets for me and my husband. It was on my birthday, so I had this fabulous treat of going to this wonderful group who is trying to get their party to see the great and rich history that they have in environmentalism. And Nils even came down to Richmond again a second time and helped with our outreach at our farmers markets and letter writing, and it's just been lovely, and I will miss him so much when he goes back to Germany, but I've really appreciated getting to know him.
Right. Okay. Yep. Thank you so much, Ellie. All right, everybody. So a big month in front of us again. Again, we would like you to write those letters while you were there. There's about a 99% better chance of letters being written if you do it before you leave the meeting. If you're planning on coming to the conference and you haven't registered yet, please make sure and get yourself registered. We do want to, if it's possible, cover the entire House and Senate, and we need to know if we have enough bodies there to do so. So if you're planning to come to the conference and you haven't registered yet, go ahead and go to the website, get yourself registered so that we know who is coming. So a lot of great months again this month. I trust that we'll make at least as much as that happen between now and the call on the first Saturday in June. And last to Nils, I would just say, ich liebe dich and wir haben dich lieben. All right, thanks everybody
Mark.
For a great month.
Mark?
Oh, is it Nils?
Can
I can't.
Yeah,
go ahead. We'll give you a minute.
Okay. Okay, sorry. I didn't actually know that I could unmute myself here. So it is moving to hear. Well, it's moving to hear the stories from both Magic Alice and your praises, Mark. I'm argumentative. But I'm not as good at giving speeches. So thank you all very much. Yeah, it was an uplifting experience working with everyone, and I'll be in touch even from across the Atlantic.
Yep, and we'll be in Europe soon, Nils. You're not going to get away from us for too long.
Okay. All right. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Thank you for jumping in. Thanks, everybody. Goodbye. Have a great weekend.